and he was literally scarfing up raw meat with another guy they had found, maybe spoiled hamburger or something, and then, you know, they're eating it. And he's like, I work all day. I don't have time to go stand in a 2 mile line. You know, and so it wasn't like the homelessness I see in San Francisco. It was totally different. And having seen that for a week, I went out to this warehouse, and there were big buff guys with their families wheeling out shopping carts overflowing with the essentials that I hadn't seen all week. And these guys identified as police and military. And so what the government was doing was opening up the warehouses to make sure that those that are enforcing the regime's policies were well fed. And you begin to see food used as a tool to control populations.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking hot air. I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually, it could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Our guest today is Nate Halverson. He is an Emmy award-winning journalist and the producer for the Center of Investigative Reporting. He has degrees in both economics and journalism from the University of Minnesota, and he was awarded a 2014 McGraw Fellowship at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Nate is responsible for breaking international news about California sinking due to farmers overpumping groundwater in the Central Valley of California. And he also won an Emmy Award for reporting on the international takeover of the world's largest pork company, Smithfield, by the Chinese government. He has a new documentary coming out. It's called The Grab, and it is a film that uncovers the money, influence, and rationale behind the covert efforts to control most vital resources on planet Earth, food and water. The Grab suggests that the next world war will be fought over the basic resources rather than an ideology. The film dives into why countries like Saudi Arabia and China are investing in farmland and groundwater systems abroad, and looks at conspiracies to take America's resources while the public is distracted by other news stories. According to the U.S. Department of State, global food demand is expected to increase by 50% or over 50% in the year or by the year 2050. Plan International estimates that 345 million people in 82 countries face acute food insecurity, with 50 million people close to starvation. I need you to stop making documentaries like the one that you did, because it scared the ever-loving shit out of me.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, this was not an uplifting one to spend years of my life on.
It was, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was 7 years that you were working on it. And I'm assuming there was a lot of working on it before the documentary crew arrived. I don't know how long you shot over that time period.
Yeah, that's totally right. You know, because one of the first things I did, I think that 7 years entails when I was first asked to look at the largest ever Chinese purchase of an American company. And that was Shuangwei Meat buying Smithfield Foods. Shuangwei Meat's now WH Group. But I was asked to look into it. And at the time I knew nothing about food. I had no background in food, water issues. But I knew that the US Senate was debating it. And there was a former CIA officer who had been asked to testify to the Senate Ag Committee. And afterwards, I just started chatting with him, and I started realizing that this was more than just a one-off investment deal. This was something that increasingly folks were looking at as a national security issue.
Unfortunately, they seem to be looking at it as a national security issue after the purchase went down, which isn't great forward thinking. Not that I'm an expert in forward thinking or strategy at a national level. Was there any burden that that Chinese company had, or hurdle that they had to clear? Or was it literally a matter of having cash in hand? And then the Agricultural Committee and the government started looking at it in postmortem.
Mostly post-mortem. There are, you know, these types of large deals have to go through regulatory processes, but they don't have to go through they're not reviewed through a national security lens. That's done through CFIUS, which will look at, they're usually looking at more like technologies or military equipment or devices or technologies. And CFIUS will and does review those. But in this case, and there has been almost every year since I first did that story, across the aisle, Senator Stabenow and Senator Grassley introduced legislation in the Senate that would require CFIUS to look at large agricultural purchases like this, to start including agriculture in the CFIUS process. And that they still haven't changed that. So
that checks out. Man, what, for the listeners and viewers, can you describe the connection between the Chinese company and the Chinese government? How closely aligned are they?
Well, you know, they're really closely aligned. This particular company started as a state-owned enterprise and then had gone public on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange via WH Group. But even if it's not a directly owned Chinese business, China just has a different model of running its government, of its economy. And that means that there's usually someone from the government, from the CCP, from the Communist Party, that'll be in a large company like this. And, you know, we'll have direct communications with the CEO. And as somebody very high up in the company told me, you know, the Chinese government basically sets out its 5-year plans, and then it gives the companies the freedoms to sort of achieve those goals. But you're expected to achieve those goals that are laid out by the government, even if you're a publicly traded company. And one of those 5 years goals are securing food and water resources around the world. And that's what part of the, that's that, that was what the, one of the driving factors, if not the driving factor, for this purchase that is effectively 1 in 4 American pigs.
Which that it segued nicely into The Grab as well, which is the documentary that I have referenced already one time. What got China to that point where they decided that they needed to buy or wanted to approach Smithfield?
Well, there's multiple incidents in China's history that have led to that. I mean, I think going far back along that timeline, of course, it's the Great Famine, when I think the sort of mainstream estimates are 37 million people died in China in 59 to 61, if I'm remembering the dates off the top of my head. Inside China, they'll call it the years of natural disaster, but it was government policy that pushed forward an agenda that didn't work and screwed up their agricultural system and left them lacking adequate food supplies. And so the current leadership of China, like Xi Jinping and others, remember a time of deep, dark deprivation where there wasn't enough food and people, you know, and you have to think that if 37 million people actually succumbed to death as a result of malnourishment, that meant there were 100 million plus people that were along that same path. So it would have been a really horrible time. And they remember that. And then they begin to look around and they see that there is growing prosperity in their country. I mean, China's economic rise has been amazing. And I think one of the important things here is also that one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century was that in a couple decades, China pulled 400 million people out of extreme poverty. 400 million people, you know, I mean, talk about results.
Yeah.
But one of the issues that then comes up is if you have more middle class, and I think China now has the world's largest middle class, you have more people that can afford to eat what, you know, food economists will say up the food chain, but really they just mean meat. So you now have more people that can afford to eat meat. And meat requires a lot of grain, a lot of livestock feed, soy, corn, that requires a lot of land, that requires a lot of water. And China doesn't have enough water to grow enough food to meet that rising demand. And there have just been increasing indications in the global marketplace that the world is teetering on not actually being able to meet that demand for countries. And there was a guy, Lester Brown, who in the late 90s wrote a book called Who Will Feed China? And Lester worked within the U.S. government and then went on to, an academic career and is just a widely celebrated agroeconomist. And when that book came out, that rattled the Chinese government enough to actually officially release statements denouncing his book. And as he tells it, to send hecklers as he was touring around universities talking about it, that they would plant hecklers in the audience. truth be told, and now I've talked to people who Chinese folks that have looked into it and researched this, it was that book that really woke up the Chinese government. And they began, as the Chinese government can do, taking really rapid action to solve this. And that meant directly buying and controlling food and water resources around the world. And I think now most other nations, especially wealthy nations, have woken up to this reality. Our government, the ODNI, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, did an intelligence community assessment in 2012 on water. And that's like the highest intelligence product our government does, where they pull in the CIA and the DIA and the various intelligence communities to do this thorough intelligence assessment on water. And the whole backstory on how it was that they ended up doing that report is pretty astounding. Because they were initially resistive to it. And by the time they were finished with it, as Major General Richard Engel said, mea culpa, this is a top line national security issue. And so I think other governments have really, and then the Arab Spring, I'm kind of jumping around now.
Yeah. Well, they're all intertwined. The Arab Spring,
exactly. And I think the Arab Spring really proved the Chinese decision correctly and started pushing other countries to catch up as when these droughts and grain shortages around the world in kind of 2009 to 2012 time period, where food prices really spiked. You saw a bunch of Middle Eastern and North African countries that couldn't afford to continue to subsidize grain imports at the levels they had, which meant that they then had to begin raising prices on food items, basic food items like bread, and populations that were already upset with their governments over mismanagement and probably perceptions of corruption and other issues. I think we all get, it's just humans. It's just like a basic level. If you can't feed your kids or you can't feed yourself, but probably especially if you can't feed your kids, you get to a point of just being like, well, all right, let's go. It's go time.
It's the famous quote, the 9 meals from anarchy.
That's right. And you saw a lot of governments topple throughout the Middle East and in North Africa. After that moment, I think that was really the moment where countries went from being like, yeah, theoretically, that seems smart. You should be buying up food and water resources around the world, to being like, we are going to spend huge amounts of money to begin to buy up food and water resources around the world.
The Smithfield purchase by China. When did you realize that you were going to follow that thread and build something into what became the Grab? Because they are connected, but like you said, you found the Smithfield, or somebody presented to it first. The Grab is, I'll let you describe it, but if you could explain to me how it kind of grew and then what it became and what it is.
Yeah, the Grab is a feature-length documentary directed by Gabriella Copperthwaite, who did Blackfish about SeaWorld about a decade ago, and then went on to do scripted movies in Hollywood with Casey Affleck and Jason Segel and Dakota Fanning Johnson. Shit, sorry. I don't know Hollywood very well, so I'm not
going to
rattle off actors' names. Yeah. So, but an incredible director. And she and I, so it's a feature-length documentary directed by Gabriella. And it premiered last year at the Toronto International Film Festival, and we're really hoping that it's going to be in theaters and available widely beginning next year. It takes a look at the national security and global security implications really through a lens of the Defense Department and intelligence communities and Wall Street, of what exactly is beginning to happen with the world's food and water supply. And because there's really no substitute for us as a species if we don't have food and water, like yeah. there is if we don't have oil, or if we don't have the minerals necessary for, you know, for battery capacity, it gets really scary really fast. And so that's what it is. It's a deep dive into looking at how this isn't going to theoretically play out, but unfortunately how it's already playing out here in the U.S., you know, places like Arizona, where, you know, I broke the story about Saudi Arabia buying 15 square miles of arid desert land to tap into the aquifer, or going into Africa where large corporations are beginning to buy up huge tracts of land and displace the local communities that had relied on that for their food and their water, which is just a recipe for conflict. You know, that folks like that had come with your professional background all too often get called in to then have to deal with. And I think a lot of people in the DOD and the intelligence community say this is preventable. We don't have to be seeding conflict that will then, you know, be fires we then have to deal with and put out in the future. And so I think it's taking a look at the issues through that lens, not an environmental lens, which I think is often what issues around food and water get wrapped up in. But it's really looking at it through a national security lens.
Can you explain a little bit that 15 square mile property in Arizona that was bought by the Saudis and what exactly they are doing there?
Yeah. So you kind of asked me like how I took it from going from the Smithfield Foods purchase by China. And after that, I mentioned there was this gentleman, Daniel Slane, a former CIA officer, who said, look, you know, the intelligence community is looking at this stuff. You should go chat with them. So I did. And I realized how much broader it was than just one country. And so I began thinking, asking what other countries are running low on enough water to grow enough food to meet their populations. And one of the wealthy countries that came up was Saudi Arabia. And so I thought, okay, so where's Saudi Arabia buying? And not surprisingly, they were buying across Africa. But surprisingly, at least to me, I found that they were also buying land in the middle of the Arizona desert, like Wile E. Coyote, saguaro cactuses, Arizona desert. And the reason is because there are ancient aquifers under there, left over from millennia past, with large amounts of water. This is non-renewing water. They call them fossil aquifers because once you use them, they're gone. And so they bought about 15 square miles and began tapping into those aquifers, pumping out huge amounts of water to grow hay in the Arizona desert, and then ship that to Long Beach, where it gets packed on shipping containers and sent back to Saudi Arabia, to Riyadh. And fundamentally, and this is a key thing just to understand on a basic level, it's that 70 to 80% of the water that we use as humans goes to growing food. Mm-hmm. And so that's the major use for water. And so when you say a country is short on water, you're also basically saying it's short oftentimes on food. And so you can't actually fill up shipping containers or oil vessels, with water. It's not economical. You couldn't move enough water to meet a country's needs. So what you do is you go somewhere else and you use that place's water to grow food in that place, and then you ship the food, and economists will refer to this as virtual water. So the food becomes an encapsulation of the water. So if you are water short, like a desert country like Saudi Arabia is, what you really need to do is go to another place to tap their water to use it to grow your food and ship back the food as an encapsulation of water. And the most water intensive food products, of course, are meat products. And so the higher up the food chain you're shipping back, like China, when they're shipping back pork, you're shipping back a lot of water.
In the form of
and
pork.
So that's
yep,
how
I get it. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah. And so when I broke this story in 2015 about a Saudi company going into the desert and growing hay, what happens is the local impact is that the communities who have moved out there and are relying on that old aquifer to for their domestic wells, for their ranches, for their farming, or oftentimes just for their retirement homes. It's a lot of retirees out there. That water's just dropping every year, and eventually it's going to disappear. And in not that short of a period, but it also gets, the deeper it gets really expensive for to drill that deep or to pull the water up, because just if you imagine hauling a gallon of water up 1500 feet, it's a lot of effort and it requires a lot of electricity and it's quite expensive. So so the locals are really in an existential crisis out there. You know, are, how long are they going to be able to continue to stay out there as the water is pulled up and out of these aquifers?
Is there any level of oversight or regulation, or because the Saudi organization owns that property, they can do with it what they want, regardless of the impact to the local community?
Yeah, under Arizona law in this particular region of the state, there are no regulations on how much water they pump.
Awesome. They bought the land. That sounds great.
Yeah, right. They bought the land, they can put in the wells, and they can pump as much as they want.
Different but similar question to the purchase of Smithfield. Foreign entities looking at buying properties like this for this utilization, is there any level of screening that they have to go through, any level of this idea being taken apart or regulated, or it's just money that passes hands?
It's just money that passes hands in the U.S. economy. You know, if an American company were to try to go do that in other countries, you know, Saudi Arabia, for instance, it won't pass. Saudi Arabia is very restrictive on how much water you can pump, and has has at one point, I think, basically outright stopped using water for hay, and now is very restrictive, very minimally using water to grow hay. That's true in many of these countries that are running into water issues. In Arizona, the Western United States is running into water issues. But there is currently nothing in place that prevents companies from coming in to do this. And in part, you know, the U.S. has no national water policy. You look at countries like Israel that went from having water deficits, they instituted a national water policy, and now they actually have a water surplus, which they use geopolitically. I think they give water to Jordan, making sure that their neighboring country, that the, I think that's the largest border they have, has enough water to helping it remain stable. So the idea of a national water policy, you've seen it put in place effectively, but the U.S. doesn't have anything like that. And so it's left to the states or the regions. And states like Arizona have water restrictions around, you know, immediately around like the Phoenix area, because overpumping aquifers leads to something called also subsidence, where the land literally starts sinking under your feet. And it can lead to homes cracking, buildings tilting, just really damaging to large infrastructure projects, roads, bridges, canals. Those regulations have been in place since the 80s, but out in the countryside of Arizona, it's basically a free-for-all.
Wild West, if you will, literally and metaphorically, I guess.
Yeah.
So yep. I would roughly, the way it makes sense to me to think about it is, for a lot of these countries, they're looking at it as a spoke-and-hub model. They realize a country, China, for example, or Saudi Arabia, they're recognizing their shortfalls, so they're putting these spokes out there all over the world to bring things back to the hub, utilizing the other country's resources. How is the United States playing in this? I can't imagine that the U.S. is not at least externally looking at this as well.
Well, certainly Wall Street is. You know, there has been a real big movement of large money moving into investing in farmland, both within the U.S. and outside the U.S. So that's certainly happening. And, you know, the State Department, the Department of Defense, others are looking at it. And the intelligence community is certainly advising Congress on it. You know, right now, I think Cindy McCain is now the head of the World Food Program. I think before that, it was David Beasley, the former Republican governor from South Carolina. And as David Beasley said, if we're not funding these world food programs, we're just letting future conflict grow. And I think Cindy McCain is going to Congress right now and trying to get increasing funding, maybe even just maybe even just what they had in previous year's funding, and it's really tough. So there is certainly a recognition within the U.S. government of this issue, but how much action is going to take place, I think, is still kind of a TBD.
Yeah, it seems as if other countries, if they are going to, again, use my term, the spoke and hub, if they're the hub and they're using the U.S. for some of their spoke locations and pulling resources out of the United States to ensure their food scarcity issues are at least in check, at some point, the U.S. might have to start doing the same thing if they aren't already. And I'm just curious how far that would go before the U.S. either put some regulatory effort into this or started doing exactly the same thing to other countries.
Yeah, and U.S. is, in this case, the U.S. is in a very favorable position because right now we do have a, you know, we're a fairly water wealthy nation. We're a fairly land wealthy nation. Iowa probably is the best soil in the world. Ukraine, notably, is probably the second. And I think a lot of people, including my reporting, indicates that it was a large driver of Russia's interest in Ukraine. But there are also big issues. I know you had a guest on from, I believe, the Land Institute recently who talked about
regenerative farming.
And, you know, on the documentary In the Grab, we kind of touch on regenerative farming at the end as one of the potential solutions. But a lot of land is being lost as aquifers in a lot of arable land is being lost from soil degradation. And also from, you know, the New York Times just had a big article out on the groundwater depletions across the country. And it's not just in desert areas like Arizona. You know, the Ogallala Aquifer used to be under the panhandle of Oklahoma, and they used to do irrigated farming there, as I understand it. And they don't anymore because that aquifer has retreated and continues to retreat from overpumping. And so the amount of farmland that the U.S. is going to have available is, you know, looks like it could be in decline, and particularly prime irrigated farmland. And then the other issues that we face are as the climate heats up, you end up with more energy in the atmosphere. And so you can end up with larger rain events that result in flooding that can destroy crops for a season in areas, or heat waves that can destroy crops. And so what we're looking at is that greater variability in growing seasons is going to increase the delta on productivity and output. So the U.S., you know, and what that ultimately is probably, it will mean that the U.S. right now, I think the average American spends about 7% of their annual budget on food. That's incredibly low compared to most countries. In a lot of places, it's like half. And so you'll just probably continue to see that increase, and people will be more susceptible to food price shocks. And that does, you know, impact social cohesion, you know, when you have some people that are getting really upset because grocery bills are going up through the roof and they're having to make really drastic cuts on other parts of their spending. But the bigger impact to the U.S. will likely be that how long can we maintain the level of exports that we currently have? And what happens if the U.S. starts having to decrease, which is likely, the size of our exports and the impact that's going to have on countries that have become reliant on that, and the food price spikes in those countries that can be far less stable than the U.S. And then that's when you begin to see things like the Global Trends report that the ODNI puts out, talking about levels, you know, talking about social cohesion falling apart in countries, civil wars, and levels of mass migration that are, you know, that our species has never seen. In that, you know, we've seen the destabilizing impacts of migrations out of, you know, countries in the Middle East and North Africa on European politics. And those numbers are fairly, the current numbers of migration out into places like Europe have been fairly light compared to what things like the Global Trends report say are possible. They're talking hundreds of millions, and some of that will just be internal within Africa. But you know, things could get very unfortunate if this isn't seriously looked at and solved on truly a global, probably, level.
When you were continuing your investigation post Smithfield, breaking the story on the Saudi property in Arizona, when did Eric Prince's name first hit your radar?
Well, I was a big Jon Stewart fan. And so I had seen him go on Jon Stewart. And I think I saw him go on Jon Stewart, and I saw him talk about investing in agriculture in Africa. And that it just was surprising, you know, and it just sort of seeded this idea. And so I began asking questions as to what that looked like and what was happening and what he was doing. And I just started chatting with folks.
And then you got what you described in the documentary as the trove.
Yeah.
Do you want to, I'm not even going to attempt to describe it. I'll let you describe what it is. And that's obviously why I asked the question about Eric.
So we got access to some of his communications, and our interest was those pertaining to an operation he had to invest in land across Africa. And, you know, not surprisingly, that land included hydrocarbons and minerals, but it also, and this was the largest slice of that project, was agriculture. And so we kind of were able to take a deep dive into looking at how they were going about assessing accruing a large acreage of farmland and who the potential investors were, right? And again, not surprisingly, what you find is that it is countries that are very interested in securing their own food and water resources, as they are increasingly worried about stability within their own borders.
Did anybody from his organization ever get back to you? I know you were trying to call him a few times in the documentary. Sounds like it went straight to voicemail.
Yeah, nobody was willing to speak on the record with us. No one wanted to chat on the record with us. But you know, as you know, we had a very deep look into that operation. And you know, oftentimes we're left on the outside, looking at press releases, corporate statements, you know, quarterly reports, annual reports, where companies are obviously going to present what it is they want the public to take away from what they're doing. And what this gave us is an opportunity to say, okay, but like, how are folks really chatting and talking with each other about their intent and about what they're seeing and about what's driving this? And in this case, with the issue of food and water, I think it's of such global importance that I hope people take the time to see how those conversations look, because I do think it's illuminating. I think it's illuminating. And I was told that there was a study done by the Department of Defense that looked at food and water deprivation across Africa. And they, you know, they looked at areas where it was high, and then they put over the top of that, they ran what areas had high conflict. And the correlation between areas of high conflict and areas of food and water deprivation, the corollary there was quite strong.
If you take people to a place, whether artificially imposed or naturally imposed, where they have nothing to lose and they're literally fighting for their survival, to expect anything other than unrest, in my opinion at least, would be unreasonable.
I agree. I think it's just like, that's who we are as a species.
But then you could reverse engineer that too. You know, you could say, mm-hmm. Hey, let's look at the data on these areas and perhaps figure out some metrics that we could move, like a stereo equalizer, and perhaps increase food and water security and maybe reduce conflict absent the use of kinetic devices on a populace that's literally just trying to fight to survive.
Exactly. And I think that is what people, you know, are hoping to do. I really, you know, there's a woman, Molly John, who was the dean of agriculture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she started doing reports, I think, that were going to the intelligence communities and others. And now she's in the DOD. She's working directly for the Department of Defense, helping to look at, I think, just what you described. How is it that you can begin to move the needle on preventing those situations from ever arising? because it really, the truth is that there is enough water to grow enough calories to feed everyone on the planet today. And not just today, but in the year 2050, when there could be 9 or 10 billion people, there will still be enough water to grow enough calories to feed everybody. So it is an engineering solution. The question is whether or not global leaders or even leaders in the United States are gonna take up action to begin to solve this problem in a meaningful way.
Well, if they don't, it's going to leave it to people like Eric, who are going to try to solve the problem on their own through their own groups for the purposes and reasonings that they have versus, not that I think our government is altruistic and always has our best interests in mind, but it's an interesting, the fact that you guys got to see the inside baseball, if you will, the internal communication and dialogue and sales pitch as opposed to the external Instagram feed of just wave tops and they want to present the best image possible. That's like playing chess with somebody, but they're writing down their moves 5 steps ahead and you get to look at that before getting onto the chessboard. If people ignore that and don't pay attention to it, I think it's a huge disservice to trying to achieve that end state of avoiding this conflict before the conflict actually begins. Last year, Fox premiered the hit reality show Special Forces, World's Toughest Test. They took celebrities, world-class athletes, pop stars, and actors and put them through a grueling version of real Special Forces training in the blistering desert heat. And now, well, hell has frozen over. Special Forces is back, dropping 14 new celeb recruits into the frigid, snow-capped mountains of New Zealand. Folks like NFL star Dez Bryant, model and actress Black Chyna, Olympic champion Bodie Miller, and television personality Jack Osborne have all left their extravagant lifestyles behind to take on the biggest challenge of their lives. An elite team of ex-Special Forces soldiers will challenge these celebs' minds and bodies. They will receive no special treatment and will be handled just like any new recruit. The goal is to endure 10 days of real danger and real consequence. They'll take on tasks like crossing a ravine on a 4,700-foot mountain peak and escaping from a helicopter submerged in icy waters. There's no prize, no winner, only survival. Can they make it to the end without giving up or being medically disqualified? Don't miss Special Forces, World's Toughest Test, all new Mondays on Fox. You touched on it a little bit earlier, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but you tied it back to beef. Can you unpack that for me a little bit?
Oh yeah, this was just a fun one. So we had heard that Russia was beginning to do rodeos, like American rodeo stuff, and that they had been importing American cowboys from like Nebraska and Montana, you know. And on the face of it, it's just kind of a funny story, like these cowboys in their stirrups and chaps going out into Russia, into, you know, deep Russia. And but as we began looking into it, there was this undercurrent that Russia wants to create like a grain OPEC, a food OPEC, because it sits on a huge amount of land. Where as the planet warms, the growing season days are getting longer, which means they'll be able to increase production from a growing amount of land, and they have a tremendous amount of water. And they sit adjacent to Ukraine, which is, like I said, probably the second most fertile soil in the world, just behind Iowa.
Access to ports as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And when the Ukrainian government before the revolution had been very beholden to Russia, they had been talking about creating this grain food OPEC. And kind of going back again to the importance of water, when Russia seized Crimea, the Ukrainian response was to turn off the water to Crimea. There's a canal that comes from Ukraine and goes into Crimea, and that was Crimea's primary water source, and Crimea grew a lot of crops, and that desiccated those fields. And so now the Russian government was spending all kinds of money trying to get fresh water into Crimea, And was also looking at, you know, the potential of controlling some of the most valuable farmland in the world in Ukraine. And so, you know, these are incredibly complicated factors, and I certainly don't know what's going on in Putin's head, but what we do know is that when it came to the cattle situation, Putin himself had gone to these companies and said, whatever you guys need, we want to build up the largest cattle herd in the world. And we think that food and water are going to eventually be, you know, give us more power than our nuclear weapons and than our oil does. And so this was a top line level decision in terms of agriculture and agricultural productivity, and not just to feed the Russians, but as a geopolitical tool. And so there's just a lot of interesting side notes around that. Like when Russia invaded Ukraine, I think either the same day or the next day, China announced that it would be continuing and increasing its grain purchases from Russia. So like the initial Chinese response right out of the gate, the Ukrainian war is a commitment by China to continue with their agricultural purchases. And if the war had gone as many expected, with Russia, you know, bulldozing into Ukraine and essentially controlling that territory, that would have been a very fruitful outcome for China. Now having a very strong relationship with Russia, which controlled Ukraine, which controls the most valuable farmland in the best soil anyway in Europe.
It's a deeply tied, interwoven web. it's the type of thing that deeply seated nightmares are made of, just a horror movie and novel wrapped in together.
And so this is when it comes back to, like, you know, hopefully there will be increasing, because, you know, I view my role as a journalist as a very basic one. I just view my role as to go into the shadows or the hard to access places and pull information out and then put it in the public sphere. And that hopefully, you know, in a democracy like ours, that people will care, and that their interest will then drive Congress to make decisions based around good information. And so what I'm trying to do is just put information in the public sphere. But as you say, based on all of the information I'm looking at from our intelligence community, from the DOD, from the State Department, from what other countries are doing, the American people hopefully will become attuned to this and will push Congress and lawmakers to begin taking this more seriously than I think it currently is.
Would you consider it to be a national security issue?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's based on just talking to people that are national security experts. So I have no business determining whether or not something is a national security issue. I just don't have the background or the expertise. But I talk to people, and what I do is talk to the subject matter experts. And in doing that, it clearly has become a national security issue.
What surprised you the most when you were doing all of the research leading up to the completed documentary, The Grab? Is there any one thing that you can think back on that was a rocket going up into the night sky that just sat you down for a minute?
Yeah, maybe it was when I was in Venezuela, and I had gone there because I wanted to document and what it looks like in a country that had formerly been one of the 20th wealthiest nations in the world, where people were now standing in 1 mile, 2 mile long food lines, where there were reports of prisoners cannibalizing each other because there's not food actually going into the prison system, the Department of Correction there. And people were, you know, I mean, mass migration out of the country because people couldn't feed themselves. And so I wanted to see what it looked like, and what it looked like was people were using WhatsApp and Twitter to try to find the places that would still have food. And it was this very 21st century scene of people using technology just to try to find basic commodities to feed their families. And on a Sunday, I rolled out to, I had gotten word that the Venezuelan government was tapping into their food warehouse, which was supposed to be going into this CLAP system for low-income folks to be able to get access to food. And I went to that warehouse on a Sunday when it was supposed to be closed. And, you know, I, by that point, spent over a week driving around Caracas, documenting food lines, people's, you know, people eating out of the families. I mean, like families eating out of trash cans, eating, you know, a guy who said he worked all day. And he was literally scarfing up raw meat with another guy they had found, maybe spoiled hamburger or something. And then, you know, they're eating it. And he's like, I work all day. I don't have time to go stand in a 2 mile line. You know, and so it wasn't like the homelessness I see in San Francisco. It was totally different. And, having seen that for a week, I went out to this warehouse and there were big buff guys, with their families wheeling out shopping carts, overflowing with the essentials that I hadn't seen all week. And, these guys identified as police and military. And so what the government was doing was opening up the warehouses to make sure that those that are enforcing the regime's policies, were well fed. And you begin to see food used as a tool to control populations. Yeah, it's pretty eye-opening, and it's an unfortunate reality that looks like it could be more prevalent around the world in coming years.
Yeah. Wow. That's a pretty horrific landscape you just painted there.
Yeah, that's not great.
No. As somebody directly involved with the making of the film, if people have the opportunity to watch it, what actions would you hope that they would take after doing so?
Yeah, I mean, if they're American, I hope that they internalize it and that they begin to push our leaders to take action on this. I think we're all sick, whether you're a Republican or Democrat, of the current state of policy making in this country.
Do we have a state of policy making? I thought it was just completely broken at this point.
To take these issues seriously, because we are getting to a point with the size of our world where we're dealing with existential issues. And it would be great if folks started really pushing Congress to take these issues seriously. So I just say engage with Congress, engage with your lawmakers. And that would be a great first step. But I also just think, like you said earlier, how many people know that a Chinese company controls or owns 1 in 4 American pigs? I don't think that many. And so I think just like at a base level, like let's get the information out there and hopefully raise the level of discourse and policy making.
Yeah, my hope would be that it would shock people. The variety, you know, like any project, you have what you want it to be for people, and then people receive it. And so certain things, you know, people in Arizona might respond more to the water issues from the Saudi farm than somebody would respond over the issues of the 1 in 4 pigs being owned. But whatever it is, I hope that it shocks people and that they can at least maintain that sense of shock to the point of doing some further research and then taking action upon that. Yeah. Very difficult in the world that we live in when we're consistently and constantly bombarded by information.
Yeah, it's right. And not always high value information.
I would say not often high value information.
Yeah.
But I also think that, you know, if I wanted to overwhelm a populace and get them to pay less attention to what I was doing, that's the approach that I would take. Overwhelm them to a point where you couldn't really keep up with the information as it is anyway. So you're only getting snippets. And everybody could weaponize it the way that they want to. And then while they're distracted, that seam in leadership that we talked about already, you're behind the scenes doing whatever it is you're doing for either your own personal interests or your country's interests, whatever that may be. That's what I would do.
Yeah. I mean, China just completely cuts down information to whatever it is they want you to see. I had a wild conversation with a couple who had grown up in China and had come here to do their doctorates. And I had only recently, this was probably a decade ago, I'd only recently learned about the Great Famine. And I asked them if they had heard about the Great Famine growing up. And they said, no, we didn't hear about it until we came to your country. And I said, well, how do you know that it wasn't my country making up lies about your country? How do you know that it was really your country that was suppressing the information, right? Just like on a fundamental level, how do you know now that you're actually hearing the truth and what you came from wasn't the truth? And she told a really devastating story that her grandma had told her about essentially about cannibalism in the small village. around that time period. And so she just said it rang true. I won't go into the details because they're gnarly. Yeah, it's not great either, having a dearth of information.
I'll give you the closing thoughts. Where would you like to point people? Up to you. The floor is yours.
Yeah. Well, for folks that are interested in seeing the documentary, they can go to thegrabfilm.com, and that will have information about upcoming screenings. You know, we've kind of slowed down now our film festival tour, but we'll have, if we get this theatrical release at the beginning of next year, and then on one of the major streamers, it'll have that information, and they can sign up for a newsletter. And then I just remind people that, you know, as one of these global trends reports that ODNI said, like, the future does look pretty dark. But it's still solvable. This is all still just like an engineering problem at this point, and that if we come together and start working on it, even with our varied interests, you know, we can get this done.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. You can learn more about the film and Nate's reporting at revealnews.org/thegrab, or you can just follow the hyperlink in the episode notes below. Thanks for listening to Change Agents, an Ironclad original. We're going to be back next week with an all-new episode. Hope you're enjoying season 2.